Bonjour. Welcome to this installment of the KOJB Book Club, in which we talk with Dr. Gwen Westerman about her book, co-written with Bruce White, Minnesota Mokoche, The Land of the Dakota. My name is Melissa Pond, and I'm the librarian at Leech Lake Tribal College and host of the book club. Today's selection, Minnesota Mokoche, The Land of the Dakota, by Dr. Gwen Westerman and Bruce White, explores the connection between Dakota people, their homeland, and their ongoing history and culture. The book is amazingly comprehensive, very thoroughly researched, and it presents the Dakota perspective of Minnesota, its land, and history, and it has been awarded the 2013 Minnesota Book Award for the Minnesota State category. Dr. Westerman is Sisseton Wahpeton Dakota, an English and Humanities professor at Minnesota State University Mankato and a widely respected teacher, scholar, and writer. I am deeply honored that she was able to take time out of her busy schedule to share her work in words with us. I'm so pleased to talk to you and just really grateful for this opportunity. The book, and help me out if I'm pronouncing this incorrectly. I've been trying to practice all day. Minnesota Mokoche?
Minnesota Mokoche, yes.
Minnesota Mokoche. The Land of the Dakota is the book, and it just recently won the 2013 Minnesota Book Award for the Minnesota category. Congratulations for that.
Thank you. It was quite an honor, and we're very excited about that award because I think it will give us even a wider audience for the book and for the story.
Oh, absolutely. I am going to start in with our interview questions here. For a reader or listener that might not know much about the Dakota people or Minnesota history, what would you hope that that person would gain from reading Minnesota Mokoche?
That Minnesota is a Dakota place. And has been for beyond remembering. Our names, our language is inscribed upon the land through the place names of rivers and landmarks, cities, and often I think people who live in Minnesota don't realize the impact and the history here associated with our Dakota people. Even though every day and every time they say Minnesota, they're using a Dakota word. And that, I think, is especially important to remember, that this is a Dakota place, and we have had a long, long history here.
Absolutely. The research for this book comes from traditional Dakota oral histories and various primary and secondary historical information sources. And the text of the book presents the narrative of the Dakota people in Minnesota from a Dakota perspective of culture, land, place, and time. How did you approach taking on such a monumental task of research and in so many different forms, especially when there have been instances of Dakota culture and history misrepresented with incomplete or inaccurate information from materials print? Materials by cultural outsiders?
That's a complex question. I wish I had a simple answer. But we wanted to be sure that this story was told from a Dakota perspective, and that informed our research from the very beginning. So this has been a four-year, now a five-year project for our team. And Bruce White is the co-author with me for Minnesota Mokoche, but we each had our own research teams, and Bruce's team worked on the secondary sources that you mentioned, the French historical records, British records, maps, journals of traders and Indian agents, and then my team was responsible for interviewing Dakota people and collecting a lot of information, history, stories from a Dakota worldview. And then we had to pull all of those things together, which is, as you so noted, it makes this a task that takes on so many different forms. One reviewer said that this book would cause problems for librarians and bookstore owners because they won't know whether this is the geography, because it has so many maps and it talks about the land, or whether it's an anthropology book because it talks about culture and language of the Dakota people, whether it's history, or whether it's literature because it's very narrative. And I think that is also coming from our Dakota perspective of the way that we tell our stories, in that many times we categorize those different areas as very separate boxes, very separate designations. And we know as Indigenous people that we can't make those kinds of artificial and arbitrary divisions, that to be Indigenous encompasses our language, our culture, our history, our day-to-day life, where we work, how we worship, and those things can't be separated out. So it does take many different forms, and I think that's one of the ways that we can tell a more complete story.
Beautifully said. I have a question about how did the people that you interviewed, the Dakota people, elders, how did they respond to this book being proposed and being written?
When we first started out this project, we started this collaboration with prayer and with the full understanding of our non-Dakota collaborators that we were going to focus on Dakota values and a Dakota way of life. And I think that helped set the stage for the way we were able to work among almost every Dakota community across the United States and into Canada. And when we went out to start talking with people about stories about the land, Glenn Washichina, who is a fluent first language speaker and teacher, and also wrote the foreword of the book, already had a well-established reputation within the Dakota communities. And I think it was also well-received because of the way we approached it. You know, you mentioned in your other question about information and materials gathered by cultural outsiders. And often, I think, those kinds of people have come into our Indigenous communities to interview, to write books, to collect information, and then they leave and no one ever hears from them again. Yet their books are published and, you know, they're lauded for their valuable work, but there's never a connection back to the Indigenous communities that they worked with. So when we went out, we told people what our project was, that we wanted to gather stories about the land that helped other people understand that we have been here for a very, very long time. And our Dakota interviewees were very excited about this. They ranged in age from 30 to 100.
Oh, wow.
And from Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Montana, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. So we had a very good reception among all of the people that we contacted. And I think the fact that we were Dakota people coming to talk about the land to other Dakota people also helped make that reception much more positive and open.
Oh, fantastic. Minnesota Makoche was first published in 2012, which was the sesquicentennial anniversary of the Dakota-U.S. conflict. What was the impetus to have this book written and published?
Well, this project started in 2008, and it was part of a collaboration to gather as many resources as we could to document the presence of Dakota people here on the land. And even in 2004, Dakota people were talking about how we would respond for the sesquicentennial, because we knew that there would be a lot of books written. There would be a lot of presentations made by non-Dakota people, because it was an important, I don't want to call it an anniversary, that sounds like something you're supposed to celebrate, mm-hmm. but that it was an important time period, and a lot of attention would be paid to the history. And we thought it was important that it come out in 2012 to help counter a lot of the other publications that came out, but also because it's not about the war. Mm-hmm. It's not about the U.S. Dakota War directly. It's about who we were before 1862 as the Dakota people and who we are now after 1862. So that was a lot of the impetus to have it finished and published in 2012, so that there is a different story about us as Dakota people than just the story about the war.
Absolutely. How did you partner with your co-writer Bruce White and your respective research teams on this project?
Bruce and I were approached by an organization called the Twin Rivers Development Corporation. And they had come together specifically for creating a project that would do research about Dakota presence and tenure on the land. And Bruce is a very widely published and respected historian in Minnesota for the work he's done with Ojibwe people and their history, and had done a lot of work with treaties in Minnesota. So he had a really strong historical background. And they contacted me because as a Dakota academic and scholar, they wanted to be sure that there was definitely a Dakota person helping to lead this project, so that it wasn't another one of those books written by cultural outsiders. So Bruce constructed his team and it included Thomas Shaw, who has done a lot of work on Lawrence Tolliver's journals, who was the Indian agent here in the 1840s and 1850s, and Howard Vogel, who's a law professor and has done a lot of work on the treaties, and Kate Bean, who is a doctoral student at the University of Minnesota in American Studies and also a Dakota person. And they were responsible for, you know, digging in the archives and pulling that information together. And then my team, as the oral history part of the project, consisted of Glenn Washitana, who's also my husband, so that helps mm-hmm. a lot to coordinate projects and work, and our daughter, Erin Griffin, who's also a Dakota anthropologist. She has her master's in sociocultural anthropology, and we were responsible for going out and making the community contacts.
Oh, fantastic.
So it worked very well. It was a really interesting collaboration. We didn't always agree on everything, but we sat at the table until everybody had their say and we came to some kind of consensus about how we were going to approach the research. And that project lasted 2 years, and then it was over, and then Bruce and I worked to get another grant to do the actual writing of the book, and that involved a smaller group of people.
Okay. What were some of the interesting things you learned or found during the research process?
that one of the interesting things that we found was that a lot of people are familiar with many of the historical resources, a lot of the books that have already been written. And when we would talk about our Dakota stories, our Dakota histories, especially when they came into conflict with the written history, there was always a little bit of friction there in terms of who was the authority, which source was more authoritative. And so we had some very interesting conversations about that, and we were adamant that, you know, if this is going to be written from a Dakota perspective, that our Dakota voices should be regarded in the same way that a 200-year-old piece of paper or a 250-year-old map would be regarded as authoritative. So that was pretty interesting. I think, though, the one thing that touched me the most is that when we chose people to approach to interview Dakota people, we decided that we wanted to talk to people who weren't always the first ones to be talked to. You know, when you say, well, who knows the history? There's always a handful of names that come up repeatedly. And we wanted to talk to other people who weren't always asked those kinds of questions. And we got valuable, wonderful, rich information from our interviewees, and many, many times they were so grateful that we were there and so happy that someone thought that it was important for them to tell their story.
Oh, absolutely. What were some of the challenges of researching a book that's so comprehensive in regard to the Dakota people's connection to this land over such a long period of time?
Probably the biggest challenge was that we realized that the more we researched and the more we interviewed, the less we knew, which is often the case in a research project. You think you know something, and then the more you learn, the more you realize that there's just too much more out there to learn. And we had a lot of information at the end of 2 years. At the end of 3 years, because we did additional research in the writing process. And when we went to talk to the editor at Minnesota Historical Society Press the first time, we were very frustrated about how we were going to get all this information into one book. It was very, very important to us that the book be affordable, but also professional looking. We didn't want a little tiny paperback book that you would, you know, get in the convenience store at the airport.
Oh, sure.
We wanted a beautiful book that was well done, but still affordable. So that's always the challenge. Mm-hmm. And then our editor, Shannon Pennyfeather, said to us, well, you don't have to put everything you know in one book. There are other books to write. And they did a really good job of working with us to get this book into a larger size format than a regular paperback or a textbook. We have a lot of illustrations. We've got color plates in the center of it, and the paper feels good. It smells good.
It is a very beautiful book.
So that was a challenge, though, for us, because we knew how much information we had and how were we going to get it into 90,000 words and 275 pages.
That sounds incredibly challenging. The book is laid out very similarly to a textbook with all the supplementary informative illustrations and insets. And it's so very helpful as a reader to be able to deliberate on specific topics. And I'm thinking especially of the brief profiles on significant people and places. Was there ever an intention to have this be able to be used as a textbook? And do you know of any like courses or instructors or schools that are using it to teach Minnesota or Dakota history?
I know that the University of Minnesota is using it in several classes this semester in American Indian Studies. And there are other places across the state, other schools across the state that have used it. I used it in my class that I taught last fall, and it's been very well received by the students who've read it. And I think we didn't start out to write a textbook, but we wanted it to be an engaging read. We didn't want people to pick it up like we often sometimes pick up textbooks and go, oh,
mm-hmm.
you know, margin to margin words with no headings or maps or images or anything to break the text. And we also wanted it written in a style that was very approachable. We didn't want it to sound like theory or mm-hmm. academic jargon. And as we pulled the first drafts together, we were always thinking about what illustrations, what historical photographs, what maps we would be able to use to supplement the text itself. And then as we went along, we realized that we needed to have some kind of timeline to kind of help keep our readers with us in terms of the amount of time that had passed or major events that had passed. And that's why we put the timeline in the margins. But the significant people and places, we call those the sidebars, were topics that we wanted to be sure got extra attention, not only visually within the book, because they're actually separated from the main part of the page, but also in terms of being able to add just a little bit more information about a place or a person or an event that didn't necessarily fit within the flow of the chapter. So it's turned out that a lot of teachers who've looked at the book have commented on how easy it is to use and to read, and that they find that it's very helpful in a classroom setting, even though that was not our original intent.
I grew up in the Shakopee, Minnesota public school system, and this is the kind of book that I wish had existed, because so much of the history of that place, which is one of the Dakota places noted in your book, the history wasn't taught when I went through the school system. And to have a treasure of knowledge that you have presented in this book, it would be so enriching for one's educational experience. And it's so crucial to the telling of the story of our state, of this land.
Thank you. One of the things that we've heard a lot over the past several years when we talk about our Dakota history and you know, Ojibwe history, our indigenous history in this area, is that people will tell us, well, why didn't I learn this in school? Why wasn't I told? Why did I have to wait until I came to college to learn it? Or why did I have to wait until 2012 to learn this information? And so we know that there's been a big gap in many places, not all places, but in many places. So we're really happy that this can help fill some of those empty places. But we also hope, and we said this in the introduction, that this is just one story, and we are hopeful that it opens the door wider for other Dakota people to write even more about our land and our people and our history.
Oh, absolutely. One of the most significant things about Minnesota Mokoche is that the book talks about the current struggles, especially to have Dakota land reclaimed and recognized as such, including and especially noted having Coldwater Spring recognized as a traditional cultural property, despite the mainstream societal devaluing of oral history over written history, which you had mentioned. Do you hope or see Indigenous scholarship such as yours making progress in having those traditional oral histories recognized and respected alongside the written works of mainstream society and academia?
I think we're seeing that more and more every year with the amount of work that's being done by Indigenous people, Indigenous scholars, language teachers, cultural preservationists, as we get more information out there. And many times what we saw when we were gathering the interviews about the land and about specific places was that our stories, our traditional stories, have been there for a long time. And then we would come across other documents or a French trader's account or a map that was drawn that not verified, but our stories verified what was in those historical documents. I think that's a growing recognition that a lot of the knowledge that we have as Indigenous people and have had for a long, long time is now being recognized as valuable. There's always going to be a tension between, in my opinion, between oral sources and written sources. But I like to point out to people that the majority of texts that we rely on as authoritative started out as oral histories. And they were oral histories until somebody decided that they were important enough to write down. And that, I think, gets people to thinking a little bit about the value of oral history, even though, when we have that section in the book that talks about Coldwater Spring as a traditional cultural property and how the authorities devalued our oral histories of that place as a sacred place, a gathering place for not only Dakota people but for Anishinaabe people as well. They devalued it and said, no, this is not a traditional cultural property. You can't use it. But then they turned around and used our oral history as supportive for something else that they wanted to do. So you can't have it both ways.
Absolutely. Though I can only imagine how significant this book is to you personally, especially having the family connection with the creation of this book. Is there a section that's most meaningful to you? And if so, why?
I thought about that question for a while. Because no one has asked me that before, if there's a section that's most meaningful. I really like the foreword that is with the book because it sets the tone for everything that we are Dakota people, and we are people, and we are everywhere around. And it's a very personal foreword that was written by Glenn, and that I think sets the tone for the book itself. But I also really like something that most people probably miss, and that's the dedication that we put on the page before the foreword. And it's just a little tiny sentence in italics, and it says, Ina ohni nkiksuyapi. And that means, Mother, we always remember you. And that has multiple meanings for all of us involved in this project, whether it's our own mothers that we remember who taught us the things that we know, and our land as our mother will always remember you.
That's beautiful. And your husband's foreword is just beautifully written, and I highly recommend anyone who picks up the book pay special attention and take special time with that foreword. Just absolutely beautiful and meaningful. Has anything surprised you about the reception of the book?
I guess I shouldn't be surprised that there are always going to be people out there who disagree with it. And I shouldn't be surprised that there are people who disagree with it who haven't read it. But it still surprises me when I hear those kinds of things. It's not a surprise, but it's affirming that we've done good work in that so many people have responded so positively to the stories here. I've had people tell me that they've cried reading this book, that they've gotten angry, that they've been motivated to do something, whether it's talk to their own families about stories or to look more closely at the land itself. And I think what I especially appreciated was the comment that one of the Minnesota Book Award judges made, and that was that the story here goes beyond describing an affinity for the land, but lets us know that the people, the Dakota people, are the land and are representative of the land. And when I read that, I knew that we had accomplished what we had set out to do, that our people and our land are inseparable.
Marvelous. Are you currently working on any new writing or scholarship projects?
I'm currently grading papers.
Happy end of the semester, by the way.
At the end of the semester, I'm currently grading papers. But I have a book of poetry coming out in July from Michigan State University Press. It's called Follow the Blackbirds. And I've written in English and in Dakota, so I'm pretty excited about that coming out here shortly. My husband and I have been working on the letters that are at the Minnesota Historical Society that are written in Dakota, and I've done quite a bit of lecturing and presentations on those letters, because we've been writing in our own language since 1838, and a lot of people don't know that, and so that's something that I'm working on. And I'm also an artist, so I have some art projects that I need to get some attention to.
And I can imagine you will once the insanity of the semester winds down.
Yes. And the cover of the book is from an art quilt that I did for the Minnesota Historical Society for a show called Original Green.
That is absolutely beautiful. Dr. Westerman, who are the scholars, researchers, writers, and what are the works that inspire you in your work and in your life?
That's another one of those difficult questions.
I don't ask the easy questions.
You ask questions that make me think and are not easy to answer in simplistic terms. As an educator, I do a lot of reading. As an artist and a poet, I have a really wide circle of friends who are writers and artists whose work I really admire. And those people include Hyde Erdrich, who is a poet and an art curator and advocate, and is doing wonderful work, and writes very personally about just living life. Gordon Henry, who's a novelist and a poet and a musician. Jim Denemy. Oh, geez, they're all Ojibwes. Jim Denemy, who's a painter and just a wonderful human being. That, you know, those are the people I know on a regular basis who keep me inspired and make me want to be even more creative. But when it comes to, I guess, scholarly kinds of influences, Amy Lone Tree, who's Ho-Chunk, has a new book out called Decolonizing Museums, and I think that's an area that really is important for us to think about in terms of how we're represented, not only in literature and history, but how we're represented in museums, and I really admire her work a lot. And this will probably sound really nerdy, but I really like the work that Neil deGrasse Tyson does. He's an astrophysicist, and he's the head of the big planetarium, the Hayden Planetarium in New York City. And because Dakota people are star people, I write a lot about the stars, and we pay particular attention to the star knowledge that we have. And one of the things that Tyson says is, you know, where's the poetry of science? And it's like, I wanted to raise my hand and say, I'm doing that. I'm writing about the stars. I'm writing about the Big Bang Theory.
Oh, that is so wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And I can't leave out, I think the people who really influenced me a lot in my life and in my work are those people who are working really hard to maintain our traditions and our language. People like my husband, Glenn Washichina, and Phyllis Roberts, who understand the importance of our language and how it informs who we are. So a lot of people.
Oh, that is so fantastic. Dr. Westerman, I cannot thank you enough for allowing me the great honor to speak to you today. It's been such a pleasure to learn from you and to share your work and your words with our listeners here in the Leech Lake Nation. So from us here in Leech Lake, in the Cass Lake area, Chi-Mi-Gwich.
Oh, huh. And Chi-Mi-Gwich to you as well for asking me to come on today and be able to talk about the work that we've done. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been, again, my absolute pleasure. And I hope when your book of poetry is out, you might consider chatting with me again.
Yes, we can do that.
Minnesota Makoche, The Land of the Dakota, by Dr. Gwen Westerman and Bruce White, is published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press, copyright 2012, and is available in paperback from the Minnesota Historical Society Press bookstore, from your local bookseller, and of course, through your public library system.